What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of She or They with Kittens. I'm Kittens, and today I've got Nicolette Mason on with me. She is an Iranian, Jewish, queer, body positive inclusivity advocate. She is one of the co-founders of the Iranian Diaspora Collective, which has been doing incredible work for the Woman Life Freedom Movement. If you don't know about that, that's all, you know, the Iranian revolution action happening. She's involved in that, which is amazing. And she's done so much amazing work finding inclusivity for different fashion brands over the years. She's just so inspiring, and I'm so grateful to have her on today. It's no secret that there's been a lot going on in the world that is really heavy and sad. And if you are anything like me and Nicolette, you've been slightly crippled by that anxiety and sadness. So thank you for being patient while we maybe get a little emotional here and share with you different ways that we are processing and different advice for processing when you're feeling isolated and just struggling during hard times. And what else did we talk about? Career stuff, finding your own lane, carving your own lane in places where you don't feel represented, and going with the flow of life that might be trying to shove you in boxes, and a bunch of other cool stuff. So before we get into today's episode, please make sure you like and subscribe. Follow on Instagram at She, Her, They, on TikTok at She, Her, They Podcast. And yeah, let's get into today's episode with Nicolette. Hey, how are you?
Hi, how are you?
So medium okay, I guess. Surviving. How are you?
We're here. We're showing up. We woke up this morning.
We got ready.
Great. Yeah.
We put eyeliner on, you know.
I mean, wow.
I know. I literally the other day, I was like, I feel like absolute garbage. I started doing this like 5% thing because I'm like, I need a crumb. And I was like, okay, what's going to make me feel like a crumb better today? And I was like, I look so tired, and seeing myself in the mirror looking so tired from not sleeping and being sad, it's like concealer. Concealer will make me feel better. And it did.
5%. 5%. Yeah. That's all we need. It really, like, it does make such a difference though. Like, I've been struggling with hardcore depression, which is not unusual for me, but, like, you know, in any case, a lot of depression. I'm like, I'm actually gonna commit to getting dressed every day and see if that makes a difference. And it kind of does, which is so annoying, but it does.
I know, when you're like, if you just let yourself sit like a sloth in bed and like just be a slop kebab all day, which is so tempting, you just feel shittier.
Yeah.
But it's so tempting to just like bed rot.
So, I mean, we have to allow space for that too sometimes. Like, it's actually part of it.
Yeah. Balance though.
Yeah.
We got to have the balance. But before we get into all this, can you go ahead and introduce yourself, name, how you identify, pronouns, all that jazz?
My name is Nicolette Mason. I was born and raised in Los Angeles. I've lived in New York City for the last 20 years. My pronouns are she, her. And how do I identify? Like, a myriad of ways. It's sometimes annoying to like list all of my identities out loud because I'm like, oh, really? You want to add more? But, you know, today how I'm showing up is I'm queer. I'm Iranian. I'm Jewish. I am a humanitarian, really, like, just a human.
And same. Yeah. Same to most of that. Same to most of that. I think it's really interesting to meet so many people in the last few years that identify as queer and Iranian. Like, mm-hmm. And like, I did not have that kind of community. I'm in my 30s. Really recent. So I get so excited when I find out about someone else. I'm like, oh my God, there's more of us.
Yes. I know. It's like, it shouldn't be so few and far between. And I think I'm lucky because now, like, I have a lot of queer Iranian friends, but, you know, our mutual friend Zoya, but her and I became friends years ago. And when I met her, it was just like this light bulb moment because there were things that she and I could relate to each other with that, like, I'd never really been able to share with other people. Mm-hmm. It's really special. So yeah, I'm happy now that we have our own little queer unique community. It's really
cute. It's so cute. Yeah. I remember when I met, why are my eyes watering? When I met up with Zoya and we were just like, we actually connected properly. We found out we went to the same college at the exact same time and never met. What? I know. Isn't that crazy? Like all those years on the same, and it's not, it wasn't a big campus. I'm like, how is this possible? I don't know. We're just in our own little bubbles. I'm going to start out with a nice little light question because we need some light bits more than ever right now. What's the worst fashion? Oh, I can't talk today. What's the worst fashion decision you've ever made?
Oh my God. There are so many, but I kind of have gotten to a place where I appreciate and love my horrible fashion mistakes because at least in retrospect, I can appreciate that like I was trying something different. I was trying to find myself and to experiment. But as a, you know, a person who loves fashion, whose career is fashion, I genuinely can't narrow it down to one. Like, I feel like everything that predates me today, I'm like, that was a mistake, but I was really into it in that moment. I went through, especially in like my early queer femme New York City, kind of like trying to figure out queer community, went through like the requisite queer femme rockabilly phase.
Oh my God, I had that too. I had that in high school, but yeah.
Older than you. So mine came, you know, early 20s, I'd say. Mm-hmm. That's one of the worst. My like early queer style, I did like a lot of the deep V American Apparel tees and like vests, and there might have been a fedora in there.
Oh yeah, I had that too.
Less. I regret the fedora less than I regret the rockabilly phase.
Really? Definitely. That's surprising because I feel like rockabilly looks are at least like they have a timeless bit to them, but that MySpace era is so like I had the choppy mullet and the scene hair and the deep V's and the headbands. And I was like in high school, I'm like
the straight across headband, right?
That's my my senior photo is so upsetting that I'm like, why did I have to just immortalize that?
You know, mistakes were made, but it brought us to where we are now. And I think that's beautiful.
God, I went through so many phases. I feel like trying to find myself. I mean, it sounds like you were the same where it was like, you're trying on every trend, every new thing, every possible different vibe to see what fits. And then, you know, we're probably going to look back at ourselves now and be like, what was I thinking with?
Totally.
I don't even know. I feel
I think like, and there's layers to it too, right? Because part of it was like wanting to feel seen as a queer person, wanting to still express in a way that felt authentic to me and like my femme identity and my relationship to my femininity. But then also like, I've always been that. And so there was also a real access and barrier to being able to dress exactly the way that I want to. Mm-hmm. And really only until very recently do I feel like I have the ability to dress more aligned with what I actually like to see in fashion and what I appreciate out in fashion in general. It's really, really recent. And so like a lot of my style throughout the years, and it wasn't bad necessarily, but I was definitely like having to conform my style based on what was available. In my size. And, you know, that adds, especially when you're trying to then like meld that with identity and self-expression. And for me, fashion style is such an extension of just the self and the ability to self-express. There's like some real barriers there to being able to do that authentically.
Did you experiment with like making and altering things growing up to kind of fit with the trends? Because even I remember like skinny jeans weren't even a thing that you could go buy when I was in high school. So I was sewing my own because I just wanted them to fit. And like, there's just throughout the years, there's just way less stuff available for Totally. Everyone in different sizes, and nothing was inclusive, and things are still, you know, you're still fighting for inclusivity, which I think is amazing across the board. But how did you navigate that?
No, I did. I mean, what's interesting is, like, in high school, I don't think I was dressing for trends at all. I was just dressing to try to, like, express myself and to have fun with fashion. And so I went to a school in LA, private school in LA, and I definitely did not dress based on what was trendy. Mm-hmm. I, like, dressed very different. And, like, Betsy Johnson for me was, like, the pinnacle of, you know, like, fun fashion, and especially at the time, like, when I was in high school. So, like, that was something that I really loved and tried to emulate in fashion. I did a lot of thrifting and, mm-hmm. Upcycling, recycling, like, random t-shirts that I would find, and embellishing them or cutting them up in interesting ways. What's interesting is, like, I think maybe even in those high school years of not conforming to trends and just doing my own thing, I was maybe more of, like, an honest, pure version of myself versus mm-hmm. then trying to adapt to trends and trying to find things that fit me or that worked for me that were aligned with trends. I think that's where, like, I strayed from my sense of self a little bit more. So it's interesting because on one side, like, having limitations can really tap into your creativity and totally. To your self-expression and to your ability to, like you said, like, create your own. And then on the flip side, like, the influx and availability of trends can really muddy your true authentic sense.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I feel like that whenever I'm working on music, for example, I'm so indecisive, and mm-hmm. just as a person, like, my Libra side is just like, what are all the options and what could they all possibly be? And what is the, and, you know, narrowing down is, it's just like decision paralysis. Totally. So sometimes when I feel stuck or when I feel like I maybe have strayed from myself, whether it is with fashion or music or just, you know, anything I'm working on, I'll strip back completely and only give myself a few elements to work with. Or when I'm trying to get dressed and I don't know what to wear because I've got so much shit in my closets that I don't mm-hmm. even look at, before I even go in, I'll pick one thing and I'll be like, okay, I need to find, this is my thing. And then I need to find stuff that works with that thing.
Totally.
So, yeah, really stripping back is so beneficial, and it really challenges you to open your mind, and less really is more when it comes to being yourself and creativity. And
And it's like, it's beyond creativity, right? I think, like, in this culture of like social media and just the amount of content we're consuming, the amount of information we're consuming, the amount of like pressure to consume and conform that we're taking in all the time, it does, whether we're super cognizant or not, like, get into our heads and our self-conscious and our psyche. And I think, like, especially when you're a creative, creatives are, like, hypersensitive to everything that we take in. Or I am, at least. I'm very, very sensitive. And you do have to kind of, like, put blinders on a little bit to be able to focus on, like, okay, who am I? Like, what is the thing that I'm trying to communicate? What is the thing that I believe? Because, I mean, that's a whole other piece, right? Like, the amount of propaganda, misinformation, disinformation, like, even with really simple, basic things, like, it's not just about news, it's, like, everything, like, in all directions, we're being kind of pushed to, like, fall into one path or another.
For sure. And, do you do anything that kind of helps you return to self in those moments, or when you feel like you're straying a little bit, how do you recenter in you?
It's a really good question. I think I've been doing a lot more writing recently, and that's been really interesting.
Like, journaling?
Journaling. Not even with the intention of sharing, but really even just stream of consciousness, or sometimes, mm-hmm. like, I don't know, my brain's been doing this weird thing where it kind of structures thoughts like beat poetry. And I don't know where that comes from, but just like the amount of thoughts that I've had circulating in my brain around everything, fashion, clothes, Iran stuff. Like, so I'm just putting everything pen to paper as much as I can. I feel like that helps me find clarity. And then, you know, with my wardrobe, I think I deal with that like decision paralysis too. I'm feeling overwhelmed of like, I have a closet full of clothes and nothing to wear. Like, how is that possible?
Yeah.
And with that, it always comes back to like, what do I feel my best in? And what do I feel most myself in? And go from there. And it's like pretty consistent, right? Mm-hmm. Like the things that I feel good in, that I feel comfortable in. I always think like, those are the things that then I look best in is when I just feel my best. It's not about trends. It's not about designer XYZ. It's not about like keeping up with anyone else. It's just like, where do I feel my best?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so I think across the board with everything, that's what I'm trying to do is just like scale back. What is inside that needs to come out that like makes me feel like the best version of me?
Yeah. And like, how do you nurture that? There's yeah. so many things to just keep in mind every single day. One thing I think about with confidence a lot, and I think everybody is always struggling with confidence, whether they want to admit yeah. it or not. Every day people have mm-hmm. something. And when it comes to, at the very least, fashion as one element, but everything we do and how we present ourselves, how we, you know, what our careers are, how we show up in the world, whatever it is, whenever we're doing something, whether we're wearing something that, you know, we think and wearing could be the facade we're wearing, the clothes we're wearing, yeah. whatever it is. If we're wearing something that we think others will think more fondly of or be more attracted to or be more apt to like support or encourage or whatever, but it's not really aligned with who we are inside, you can smell it. And it looks like it's like your first time in drag and you're just uncomfortable.
Totally.
And it, at the end of the day, like it's just not worth it. And that confidence is so much more visible when you are just at ease in yourself and yeah. you let that be okay. And I feel yeah. like we're not culturally encouraged to just be okay with ourselves. We're encouraged to, you know, with all of the content we're getting, with all the messaging out there, to conform in these little ways, in these little yeah. buckets. And it doesn't always fit.
It doesn't always feel good. And like, what is it for at the end?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Like, who is it serving? If it's not mm-hmm. serving me, it's not serving you. Why do we still put ourselves into yeah. this shit? And so I think that's the thing that I have to constantly remind myself too, mm-hmm. is it's not serving me. It's not serving the people I love. How do we break out of these cycles to conform, to consume, to perform mm-hmm. for other people? Mm-hmm. And like the performance piece, it is drag, right?
Yeah.
But it's not drag that's like,
not the good kind.
Going from a place of empowerment.
Yeah. Yeah.
But so maybe it's more like a costume to wear.
Yeah.
Right. And yeah, I've been thinking a lot about like when we're performing, when we're put into positions where we feel like we have to perform, mm-hmm. who is it for? And what comes out of it? Like, to what end are we performing?
I try to keep in mind, because like, again, I'm so indecisive and I have a million different things I want to do and a million different things that are important to me. And I write a lot too, just to kind of figure out like, okay, like what is actually the things that I really care about and how can I convey those or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I just lost my point that I was going to make.
Okay. Oh, yeah. That's just Libra life.
Yeah.
You know,
Libra and ADHD is not a great combo. Let me tell you.
Just you're speaking my language. Like Libra moon, ADHD. My Vyvanse, is it Vyvancing today? I don't know.
Yeah, I'm like, do we up the doses now? Maybe. I don't know. But one thing I've started doing, and it's such a simple thing, and because I was realizing things that I was trying to do, whether it was like work I was trying to do, a project I was trying to work on, content I was trying to make. And I would just kind of get stumped and be like, why is there such an hump here to get over to do the thing that I'm saying that I want to do? Mm-hmm. And I realized I don't know what the purpose is. And if there isn't a clear purpose to me, I'm super purpose driven. I'm not just going to do things to like get attention or because we're told to do things. I need to feel a genuine deep purpose and connection to the point of why I would do something, or else I'm not going to do it. I just know I'm not. And so that's kind of what I do when I feel like I'm hitting a wall or something's not clicking or something feels like I'm missing an element of motivation. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, what's the point of this? What's the purpose here? And if I don't have a good answer for that purpose, and that purpose that I state isn't something that moves me, mm-hmm. like on a deeper level, then I'm tossing it. Like there's no point.
Yeah.
You know, there's no point. So
that resonates hard. And like sometimes the purpose is just like, okay, got to pay my bills. Like, you know, the purpose is survival and that's mm-hmm. fine too. Like that is a purpose, right? Yeah. But it's so funny. I'm like thinking back, I don't know why this brought like up this memory for me, but I kind of like fell into social media content creation by accident. It's mm-hmm. not something I like pursued as a career, even though now there's like a necessity for everyone's a creative to also be a content creator and, you know, create our digital resumes in this way. But I would get asked for like tips on how to be a content creator and how to do XYZ. I'm like, I literally like can't give the advice because I know the things that you're supposed to do, mm-hmm. but I don't even believe in doing them. Like, I'm not going to just like post for posting sake or because this is what the algorithm wants or like, this is, I'm like a content creator who doesn't create content because if it doesn't hold value for me, I'm just like, I'm not doing it in that way.
Right. Yeah.
So, that's such a tangent, but it is just like the thing that came up to me is like being invited to like speak about like becoming a content creator and building your personal brand. I'm like, I'm the worst person to speak about this because
I think that's like
authenticity.
Right? Yeah. That's
following a game plan or formula.
Totally. And I think that's more important to hear, honestly. And I get why they're having you come speak, because we're constantly fed the things that like Meta and TikTok are telling us to do of like post 90 times a day, just for shits and giggles.
Yeah.
But if you don't have the authenticity behind it, if you don't have the point and the purpose of the content, then, you know, maybe you'll get like lucky for lip syncing to random trending sounds and people fuck with that. Cool. But like they're realistically, what's the value add and why are you doing it?
Right.
I think people need to ask themselves that question. And a lot of times they just don't.
Yeah, I know. And I had a friend who was at a like creator summit type of thing recently. And they came back and they were like, I have to post in feed 3 times a day, blah, blah, blah. I was like, but why? And they were like, well, because that's how you grow. I was like, but who's giving you that information? Because if it's a social media platform telling you like, all right, you got to go in, post 3 times a day, be engaging on everything, post on your stories 24 times a day. It's because that is what they want because it benefits them.
Exactly.
It doesn't benefit us as humans. It doesn't benefit us as creatives to like constantly just be online and be on social media, taking in all of this information, being forced to engage, like submitting ourselves to these algorithms and AI tools and da da da.
Yeah.
It is literally the product of the social media platform to have people be online more because that sells ads.
It
increases their usage, their traffic. It's a trap.
It truly is the biggest trap, the biggest trap. So you're obviously a trailblazer for inclusivity in fashion. Can you just talk a little bit about how you got started in that? I know you went to Parsons for design, right?
Yeah.
And then you started blogging and now you're here. Like how did that happen?
Yeah. Like I said earlier, it was really a series of accidents and which like I don't totally recommend. I do and I don't. But okay. So I went to school, Parsons School of Design. I studied design and management. I did a bunch of fashion internships while I was in school. And then I graduated in 2008, like notoriously bad time to be entering the job market.
Yeah.
I was really, really lucky. I did get a job at a branding and design agency, totally unrelated to fashion, but I had a job and I was just really excited to be working. And it was a great job, really great company, you know, coworkers that I'm still in touch with many, many years later. But it wasn't really what I loved. And so I started blogging, and this is like 2008, 2009, on like my little Blogspot blog. It was just like nicolettemason.blogspot.com. Yeah, like I had zero intention of anyone looking at this, right? It was just like, for me, it was kind of like what Pinterest is now. It was a place for me to like save my inspiration and catalog some of the things that I liked. And I was, you know, posting runway photos, and I was also posting photos from art galleries and travel and like occasionally a photo of myself. And I remember looking at my Blogspot one day, and I was at work, and so it was like my lunch break or something, and I was like, oh my god, 70 people looked at my blog today, like what the hell? Like I thought it was just me and my mom, you know, like checking in on what I'm posting. And then I started posting more and like a little bit more personal, a little bit more of my own point of view, not just photos of other things. And also like moonlighting for different publications. So I like had made these connections and friends through LiveJournal, actually, who were like in body positive fashion spaces. And Gabby Gregg was one of the first people who I connected with, who is still one of my very best friends. And she, I remember she was like, I've never seen a fat girl who like also wears like Chanel accessories. Mm-hmm. And like that was something that was like really striking to her. And she was like, you should post more of your outfits and your personal style. And so anyways, all of this is happening in tandem. And it's like so long ago that everything is kind of blurred together now. But so I started writing for Vogue Italia because Gabby introduced me to an editor there. And I was writing for Refinery 29 and I was writing on my own blog. And I got an email one day from an editor at Marie Claire, and she wanted to meet me and come in for a meeting. And I had written this blog post. There was like something that was published on the Marie Claire website about like the show Mike and Molly, which was the Melissa McCarthy show. And then there was this like really fat phobic response to the show. Mm-hmm. And like the point of my blog wasn't necessarily like body positivity or, you know, activism in that way. But it was also just part of my lived experience that like I was in a bigger body and I wanted to be able to have fun with fashion, and I wanted to share resources for other people who similarly had bodies that had been left out of fashion, disenfranchised from fashion, and be able to share what I was finding. And so anyways, I had written this blog post about the Marie Claire article, and so when I got this email, I was sure like they were calling me in to have me take down my blog. I was going to get sued. There was going to be a cease and desist.
Oh my gosh.
And instead it was like, hey, we really love your point of view. We love your approach to personal style. Would you be interested in working with us and writing for us? And that was really, really life-changing. It definitely wasn't something I expected to happen, but I kind of felt like, okay, like this is something I have to do. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I left my full-time job. I gave myself this like idea of, okay, I'm going to commit to doing this freelance fashion thing for a year. And if it works out, great. And I was babysitting still at the time. I was tutoring a couple of kids here in the city. As like, whatever I can do to just like make this work and try to make this work, I'm going to give it a shot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, years later, I evolved into like, I was at Marie Claire for 6 years as a contributing editor. I have worked with dozens upon dozens of brands to help them with their extended size launches. I've worked in media. I've launched my own brand. I've worked with other friends and colleagues to launch their brands. And just like every year, I'm like surprised by where this leads me. And it's definitely something that I still do. Less in a like front facing, like me as a writer or me as a content creator or influencer capacity, but in this behind the scenes consulting way. And I really, really love it. I really love it. It's been hard to see the ways the industry has evolved at times, because like, I feel like a few years ago we hit this kind of like incredible moment where it felt like everything in the fashion industry was shifting to be more inclusive. It was more gender inclusive. It was more inclusive of people with disabilities. It felt like racial diversity had hit this pinnacle in fashion as well. And then body diversity was part of that conversation too. And it does feel like things have slid back a bit the last few years, big time. And it's not just like a feeling, they have.
What do you notice with how things have slid back? Because I definitely notice a difference in just in ad campaigns and
totally. Like,
yeah.
I mean, you know, I think this is part of the issue, is that the foundation of the fashion industry, like any industry that is based on capitalism, is one that is exclusionary and is at its core archaic. And I think that there was this cultural imperative and social imperative for a lot of brands and a lot of designers to appear more inclusive. And so the marketing was more inclusive, the visuals were more inclusive, the campaigns were more inclusive. But at that actual foundational level, these businesses were not operating and are still not, for the most part, in a way that is actually inclusive. Mm-hmm. And so if like the foundation of these institutions, whether it's media and magazines and publishing or brands themselves, if those are not changing or evolving at all, it's not going to be sustainable long-term change in terms of how they function with inclusivity, right?
Right. They're just kind of chasing the front-facing trends.
Right. And like what is socially valuable for them in that moment, rather than like really committing to change. And there's, of course, exceptions to that. There are brands and businesses that I think like really take this as part of their mandate and have made it part of their core. But for the most part, as an industry, it's like, what is trending in this moment? And for that moment, inclusivity was trending. And that's,
I hate that, it's gross, right?
And like, I so believed that that was real. And I think so many of us did, like, so many of us like had this really beautiful optimism and maybe like a little bit of naivete that things were changing, but they were only changing in so far as it would not hurt them to not appear like they were changing.
Right.
And so, you know, they're like anything that is rooted in capitalism, they're going to chase like their bottom line over anything. And so I think for me, it's been really important to separate my sense of self, my, my sense of confidence from like what I'm able to do through capitalism and as like a consumer, because my self-worth cannot be based on something that fluctuates like that, right? But that's really hard. It's really fucking hard. It's really hard when you just want to be able to get dressed and you've been getting these messages that like you're allowed to participate in this broader conversation of fashion. we're giving you permission to be part of this now. And then it's like, oops, just kidding, not anymore. And so it's like, and who is it then on like the onus of people who have been excluded, disenfranchised, et cetera, to like combat these systems of homophobia, transphobia, ableism, fat phobia, et cetera. Like it's on us as individuals to counteract that impact that the, mm-hmm. like these brands and media and everything like have. That's a lot of work.
Yeah. Yeah. How do you like, I feel like anytime we have moments of difficulty really facing like what the reality of things is, seeing like, you know, maybe things aren't as inclusive or people yeah. don't care as much as I thought they did, and they're yeah. they're not as supportive as I thought they would be, or whatever hurdles that come up. And that's with the kind of work that you do, but also people who are maybe shifting into being self-employed versus mm-hmm. having a job, or content creators. It kind of applies across the board. When you hit those moments of, I guess, just struggle mm-hmm. and questioning, is it worth like pushing forward? You know, how do you reconcile that? Have you had those moments, and what have you done to get through them?
Hmm. Of course I've had those moments. I think anyone who says they haven't is being dishonest, to be real. Of course I've had those moments. I like, with so many pieces of my career, not even just with fashion, I have these moments of reflection and isolation also, because I think like feeling lonely is a big part of it. Where I'm like, what is this even for? What is it?
Yeah.
Like, it goes back to what we were talking about earlier about purpose, right? Mm-hmm. What is this for? Who am I doing it for? Who does it serve? I struggle with that a lot. And I don't have an answer, but I do think that if you are a person who cares about change and you care about progress and you care about making the world slightly better in whatever way we're able to, it is always worth it to try to whatever extent we can. And like what form that takes is going to change all the time. Like what mm-hmm. form that takes for me today might be different than tomorrow, definitely different than like 3 months ago. But to the extent that we're able to make a positive impact, mm-hmm. I always think it's worth it to try. And it doesn't have to be like all or nothing either. And like, yeah. that's the place where I try to give myself grace. I try to give other people around me grace too. I think that this is like culturally a problem that we're forced into these binaries of like, it's this or that.
Right.
And that's not how the world works. Like, we are not people who operate exclusively in binaries. And so the impact that we have, the decisions that we make, don't also have to conform to these arbitrary binaries. Mm-hmm. Like falling anywhere along the spectrum of this or that is also an option.
Yeah.
And so like, that's where I'm trying. I don't like, it's not the perfect answer, but it's where I try to find myself is like, where the opportunities are for progress and improvement, and also like challenging the status quo. I think that's a big piece of it for me. Like, where are the places, even if it's just in conversations with friends, that we can challenge and push back on the status quo and use whatever individual privilege or power we have to maybe shift away from the status quo and to some extent. And so, and like, that's actually like a place of incredible power that everyone has in different ways, like relative mm-hmm. to their own space, their own community, their own, you know, positions that they have. But that's not powerless. It's like quite powerful and empowered mm-hmm. to be able to use what we do have to create change and create totally. Momentum.
When it comes to change, I think, you know, you're an advocate for so many different causes and so many different things, because you've got yeah. so many different little identity factors yourself that you're connected to, how do you balance caring and having a heart and like sensitive human emotions and wanting to advocate openly for the for these things, for marginalized voices? How do you balance that with the mental health need of like, you know, processing and pausing, and also your business? Because I think a lot of people are scared to say anything when it comes to marginalized voices of any sort, because it can be taken so many different ways. So how do you find that balance of using your voice and also protecting your peace and your business?
Ooh, how do I find that? Girl, I don't. I like straight up balance. Never met her. Never heard of her. I've heard she's like out there somewhere. We're not even acquaintances. Like, straight up, I don't.
How do you navigate then? Maybe not balance isn't the right word. How do you manage? How do you juggle?
Okay, there's a few things. So like the piece about like marginalized voices, I think for me, I think it's really important to center the voices of people who are at the center of like whatever marginalization you're talking about. And so the way that I approach that is either by like centering other people's voices, if it's an experience I don't have, but like you said, like for better or for worse, a lot of these are my experiences and my lived experience and something that is very, very personal for me. Which I think is also why it's so hard for me to find balance. It's like,
yeah,
how do I not care?
There's always like, you know? some queer group is being attacked. Jewish people are being attacked. Iranian people are being attacked. Iranian women are being attacked. Queer, like, it's just, there's something every day. So how the hell do you decide when to just pause?
This year has really challenged me in a way that I've done a lot of therapy. You know, I'm like I was a
we love therapy
fat kid who grew up in Beverly Hills. Like, of course, I've had a lot of therapy, and like, so I've had a lot of therapy, and I have a lot of tools, right, to like help me feel centered, help me feel grounded. But the reason I say this last year is because, you know, we know this very, very intimately, but the Women Life Freedom Movement in Iran that followed the killing of Gina Mahsa Amini kind of broke something open in me that I had never really expected to be activated in this way. Mm-hmm. And so my relationship to balance and my ability to self-regulate has been challenged in ways and confronted in ways that like I really wasn't prepared for. And so I'm really honestly like struggling to find that balance and to find the place where I feel like, you know, where do I allow myself to come out of this super adrenalized phase or a really adrenalized space where I'm like constantly activated, constantly feeling like I have to do this because it's like life and death for for someone, right? And I just like, I don't have an answer, honestly, because like I keep waiting for that shift. And I didn't want to get emotional, but like a few weeks ago, a 16-year-old girl named Armita Garaband was assaulted on the Tehran metro, and she had fallen into a coma following that assault. And that same week, Narges Mohammadi, who's an incredible Iranian human rights activist, was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize while still in Evin prison in Iran. And I had this moment of like, everything is going to change now because people are going to pay attention in a different way. And I felt like after, you know, this year of like nonstop activism, advocacy, how do we get people to care? I co-founded a nonprofit organization called Iranian Diaspora Collective. Like, I've really made this the core of what I do with my everyday life outside of my fashion career. And you know, that everything has shifted in that time, like since this happened a few weeks ago. And there's so many more crises that have emerged since, and there's so much more urgency across the board to advocate for human rights and to advocate for collective liberation. And I feel like I had already kind of been approaching this place of burnout. Yeah. Because I haven't stopped over the last year.
Yeah, literal over a year now.
Yeah, like since, you know, it was September 16th. I remember so distinctly. I had a work trip and I came home from my work trip while you know, the protests had started in Iran, and I tested positive for COVID. And like the first videos I made, like talking about the uprisings in Iran and this emerging women-led revolution, I did from this room, like with COVID. And I haven't stopped since then. Like I've like traveled, I've like, you know, but even when I traveled, I'd still been very focused and very on with this movement. And I just took us in such a tangent that I don't think was really answering your question, but I think
No, I was actually going to ask you about all this stuff, so we just
like,
got
the
there.
Point is, like, when it's something that is so personal, it's really, really hard and challenging and confronting to find balance. Mm-hmm. I remember a few years ago I was going through a really, really hard time, and my therapist was like, either you have to like give yourself a break now, or it's going to be very expensive and difficult to get yourself out of like the involuntary break that you will go into. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I did a few years ago, like take a real, real like leave of absence in a way from everything in my life, where I just like completely disconnected. And that's not sustainable. So I think I need to figure out ways to detach and give myself breaks. Cause it does, obviously, with any form of activism, any form of work, anything creative that we do, like it does allow you to show up better as an activist, as an artist, as a creative, as a partner, as a colleague, like all of the many things. If you have time to center yourself and decompress and self-regulate. And I'm not doing a good job of that. And I know that. And I see like where it's hurting myself, and I see where it's hurting other parts of my life, and my ability to keep showing up in the ways that I would like to as an activist. So yeah, I'm going on a trip next week. So maybe I'll figure that out then.
I mean, honestly, I think this
first time ever.
I think this is something that's helpful for everybody to talk about, because, like you said, it can be so isolating to feel these things. Like, I was, you know, the last few weeks with everything going on between Palestine and Israel, I was crying myself to sleep every day, and I would see anyone post something and acting normal, posting their like, get ready with me, whatever. And I was just filled with rage, because I'm like, how are you not feeling this right now? Yeah. And it made me feel so alone in that, just that anger and sadness. And that's why I think, even if we don't have the answers and we don't know how to balance and we don't know how, that's fucking okay, because I don't think anyone does. And I think the people that are operating at a normal, like, functioning level, I don't know what part of their like emotional processing is turned off. I'm glad mine's not turned off. I'm glad I can feel everything, because I would hate to be numb and to be able to turn away.
Completely. But
I think having open discussion and sharing that, people, even the ones who are at the front lines of activism, even people who seem like they've got it all together, nice and polished, like, we're all fucking struggling, and that's okay. And we can also struggle together. And I think, kind of a like, maybe this is morbid, but like when you go to a funeral, and you're crying with everyone, it feels better than sitting alone in your room crying. You have that, like, that community kind of collective grief processing that in commiserating together, it has, maybe it's a kind of primitive animal part of us that we are able to feel better by having that community processing happening. So
it's interesting that you bring it up in that way, because like I've been thinking a lot about grief and like mourning rituals and how important they are. Like, and I don't actually think it's like a primitive thing. I think it's really valuable, and it's,
I don't mean primitive like bad, I meant innate, like, you know,
I think it's like, yeah, it's so human. Mm-hmm. So human. And you know, even like elephants have grieving rituals, right? Like they have funerals where like literal elephants will have spaces where they come together to mourn when another elephant dies. And like I think that is also part of this like social media culture that we're in, where we're experiencing these enormous traumas in these silos and by ourselves, mm-hmm. and behind a screen, when like we actually really need to be in community often.
Totally.
And so I like what you're saying about like seeing other people's like selfies and their OOTDs and like they're out to brunch. Like it made me feel insane. It made me feel really, really insane. Right.
Yeah.
But then there's this other piece of me that like posting isn't the end all be all. And I don't know what those people are doing outside of mm-hmm. the 2 minutes of their day that we see. Right.
And they're allowed to have time to, we have to find little bits of joy and breaks to get through.
Yes. So I think it's just like this struggle of like, I need to remind myself that there's like, there's a lot of life that happens not on this. And like the more life that we're able to have, the more we're able to engage with people, the more we're able to be face to face and like have difficult conversations and like grieve together and process together and unpack together, that is like the best thing that we can do for ourselves.
Totally.
I'm like having a lot of internal conflict and like dialogue around tech and psychology.
Mm-hmm.
I did a whole like deep dive on Instagram recently, ironically, like the platform that I'm having this
most issue with,
right? Like, yeah. So but I think it's really important. Like there's amazing things that come out of social media. There's amazing abilities to connect with people, to learn, to like hear different perspectives. But also it's really important to cultivate community and connection outside of social media.
Mm-hmm.
And like grieving is definitely one of those things that like, we got to be with our people. We really do. Yeah. We actually need to like hug it out. And like, mm-hmm. there's real science behind like hugging someone for like 8 seconds. Right.
Yeah. It totally resets your whole nervous system. Yeah. Like,
yeah. So like this is part of the work too, is like being in person and in community and recharging and like getting energy from that.
For sure. I noticed I went to a rally this weekend.
Yeah.
And like I had so many people in my life being like, it's not safe. This is like the worst time to go. It's crazy. And I was like, I don't care. Like, you know, I have the purpose to show, I want to show up for the people who need it, but I also need it. Like I need to be around people who are feeling the same way I'm feeling right now. And I need to be able to yell and feel that community, because like, I feel like I'm going fucking crazy over here.
I've like completely unraveled. And yeah, I've never been to a rally or a protest where I haven't had this incredibly emotional response of just like bursting out crying.
Same. And it's every time.
Every time. And like every single, and I've like been protesting since I was like 15 years old. Like, you know,
it never goes, it's not like you get numb to it. It's just this like overwhelming whoosh of, I don't even know what it is, but
it's connection and it's community and it's you know, feeling and seeing the way people show up for others, for mm-hmm. each other, for themselves, it's really powerful. It's, you know, when it's good, it's like, it's humanity really showing humanity at its best.
How was it with your upbringing and being queer and having, are both of your parents Iranian or?
No. So my mom is Iranian. My dad is English, but like my whole family is Iranian. Like my dad was the outlier. I don't have extended family on my dad's side. I don't have cousins or like,
got it.
It's just my dad. And right. So the family that I grew up with was just yeah. Iranian.
Mm-hmm.
So no, but I'm like, my last name is Mason. So, I'm mixed. But how is it growing up queer? I mean, like now it's great.
Yeah.
Now it's great. Took a minute.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think like it's interesting. Both, I love my parents so much. They are really, really the best. But we've done a lot of processing. So I'm going to be honest about this too. They were so concerned with how other people, especially in the Persian Jewish community that I grew up with, would think about them.
Mm-hmm.
That I wouldn't say they did their best of like accepting me as a lesbian and like accepting, you know, that as part of who I was. It was very much like, don't tell anyone.
Right.
What are they going to think of me as a parent? What are they going to think of me as a mom? And that was really, really hard for me, obviously.
Yeah, of course.
And, but I will say, like, I have a cousin who is also queer. And when my cousin came out, my parents were like the fiercest allies of like, you have to accept them no matter what, and like unconditionally love them. And I'm like, I know you have to go through the process with me to get here, but I'm really, really glad that this is where you ended up. It wasn't
always. What was the turning point for you? Because like I had a similar experience, and I feel like there was a few like moments where I was like, okay, we really got over a big hump there, and now we've got like another one, and like we're slowly getting there.
I don't know. I actually don't know what the exact turning point was, but I think like for all of us, it was either my parents could either have a really good relationship with me and be part of my life and be part of my partner's life, or they could not accept me entirely as I am and not have a relationship with me in the same way. Mm-hmm. Right. And so I think like ultimately it was them deciding like they wanted to have a relationship with me. They wanted me to feel good, like being around them. Mm-hmm. I live across the country. And so like, you know, would I be visiting them in LA as much as I do if they hadn't turned the leaf on their own?
Right.
Probably not. Yeah. So I'm really close with my parents. Like we talk every day. We have a really, really strong bond and relationship. It's not always easy still, but I think like for any parent, right, it's like, do you want to have a relationship with your child or not? And yeah. If the answer is yes, it means like really showing up and loving them unconditionally. Mm-hmm. And I think that like now, you know, I have a lot of friends who are becoming parents. My sister actually had a baby today.
Oh my god.
Which is life. Really auntie life. It's the best. I love being a child-free lesbian auntie in New York City. It is the life that I was made for.
Can't imagine a better situation.
It's the best. But like, you know, for my friends or people I know who are having kids, it's like, you have to, if you're not prepared to love your child, whoever they are, whoever they become, you should not become a parent.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I can say that because I don't have kids. It's like easier for me to say that, but it's also something like I just really believe because I've seen way too many friends of mine, especially in queer community, become completely estranged from their families. And I've seen like how much that hurts them. And, know, what kind of like trauma they're holding onto from not being able to have a relationship with their family. And like, that's not something any child, it's not on them, you know?
Yeah.
It's not fair. So yeah. No, and so I'm really, really, really lucky to have the relationship that I have with my parents now, and that they were able to like figure out their own shame.
Yeah.
You know, and their own, like, what will people think of me, so that we can have this relationship.
Yeah. I think it's really important to tell these stories too, because so many kids that are struggling or are just coming out or are scared of coming out, they feel like, okay, if my parents don't accept me, like, you know, immediately the second, then I'm fucked forever. Or they're going to kill me and that's it. And for so many people, or maybe they do, and it's like they're going through that hard point of feeling like they have to walk on eggshells and censor all these things about their life around their family. Some people just take a while, but it can totally come around and you can have these amazing relationships with your family. And, you know, maybe one parent's going to be incredible and accepting, and the other one's going to suck for a while, but there's so much hope that eventually people can get over their own shit and, you know, show up for their kid in great ways. Yeah.
That takes like effort from all parties, you know? And so like, I do get why, like for some people, like there comes a point where you have to stop putting yourself in a position of getting hurt. Like that's real too. But if it starts out rocky, it doesn't mean it's going to end that way. Like there can be a lot of growth and a lot of healing and a lot of working together and processing through it. Yeah. And like, I think it's worth it for people who like value those relationships and want those relationships.
Totally. This is something I ask everybody. What is your dream creative zone? And that means no rules, science, physics, like nothing matters. You could be under the water on the moon with like fairies and cotton candy floating around.
It is in water. It is totally in water. The hard thing is like, I'm really genuinely a writer. And so I can't write at like my thoughts are perfect and beautiful when I'm like suspended in water. But I don't remember them. So
maybe, you know, a bubble in the water,
where like, there's also a way to transcribe all of my thoughts. That would be great. And also like this bubble in the water is probably like off the coast of Italy. It is really warm. I'm just like floating, kind of buoyant, you know. And like on shore, there's something delicious and refreshing waiting for me.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah, my dog is there.
Obviously. Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, that sounds nice. I love water too. I'm like, my girlfriend always makes fun of me because I will be in the shower for like an hour and I sit there. Mm-hmm. She's like, what are you doing? I'm like, what do you mean? What am I doing? Like, why would I not be doing this? I'm just sitting there reflecting and having the water on me, and the noise is so just like, I think about the best shit. I decompress better. I just feel like,
I'm a big bath taker, and like, I'll like, you know, sometimes my partner will be like, oh, are you like showering or are you like going to be there for 2 hours? And I'm like, what do you mean? It's the same thing.
you already know. You already know what's happening here.
Well,
amazing. Thank you so much for doing this. I'm so happy to have you.
Thank you.